Tonight on Arena. We talk about denouement at the Lyric Theatre, mark the centenary of Gore Vidal's birth, and Alan Partridge is back on the Beeb. You can text us tonight, as usual, of course, on 51551, email arena@rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at @rte_arena. It's time once again on Arena to take a trip into a possible future. It's the year 2048, and in a remote farmhouse at the base of a mountain, Adele and Liam are living out their final hours before the world ends. It's the setting for the play Denouement, which will premiere at the Lyric Theatre next month as part of the Belfast International Arts Festival. Writer John Morton and actor Anna Healy, who plays Adele, both join me this evening. Welcome to Arena. John, I'm going to start with you first. It's the premiere of the play, but you actually wrote it in 2020.
It was initially supposed to be on in 2020. Yeah, it was supposed to premiere in August 2020, but obviously COVID really got in the way. So the production got postponed. And I suppose with the nature of the play and what it's about, it wasn't necessarily the kind of play I think that any of us were running to do or see immediately after a pandemic. But there's been a little bit of time now and a bit of space. So,
yeah, that's the next obvious question. It does feel like possibly in 21, 22, 23 that it may have been slightly too close to 2020. So why now? Why is this a good time to put it on?
I think because we've got a little bit of perspective from the pandemic years. You know, the play initially, when it was commissioned and when we were developing it, it seemed very novel that you'd have this play that's kind of set in a dystopian future, and it's about two people who are effectively locked in their houses, and there's this unspecified apocalypse happening outside. And it's really focused on their relationship and the fact that they're kind of in survival mode. And that felt really novel at the time we were going to produce it in 2020. And then obviously post-pandemic and the original production not happening, everybody has lived that experience. So that was a strange way to reapproach the play. It was going from something that was a little bit of fantasy, and now it's like everybody's kind of gone through that a little bit over the last couple of years. So now it feels like we have a little bit of perspective, but also I think a lot of the ideas are probably a little bit more pertinent, you know. I guess it's, you know, because we're living at a time of, there's a lot of unease and discord and the general kind of existential fear of, I guess, the environment, and also like political instability and chaos and all of that. So now what was kind of a bit of a sci-fi and maybe a bit of a fantasy seems like it could be a bit of a roadmap for where we could be in 30 years. Hopefully not, but not to that extreme.
And it does feel a little bit more like lived experience as well, given, as you say, the nature of there just being two people. They are within one house and they are slowly starting to lose their grip on whatever reality is left around them.
Yeah, I mean, they're in the last hour of all time, and that's like the ultimate ticking clock for a play. You know, it's it offers a lot of meaty dramatic possibilities in terms of two characters who've lived a life together and sometimes apart, and they're trying to kind of reconcile their own lives and their collective life, and they have a short amount of time to do it. So immediately once the play starts, that clock is ticking, and it all kind of becomes about what you shouldn't say, what maybe can be unsaid, and what you need to say. So they have this short amount of time in which they really need to kind of reconcile their relationship and all the things that they maybe don't know about each other.
Anna, you play the character of Adele in the play. She's in a relationship of more than 40 years with Liam, who's played by Patrick O'Kane. It's a role that you really wanted, apparently. Why so?
Well, I've had a marriage that has spanned 34 years of marriage, and I've known him for at least 40 years. And I read this play. I read it as a new piece of work when it went into development first. And I've actually done two public readings, or one not public reading and one public reading in Galway for Druid of the play. It's a fantastic piece. And it's Adele is a fabulous woman. She is still fighting for her relationship in the last hour of time. And I feel maybe Maybe I'll be fighting for mine till the last breath I take. I love that John is so young and that he's observed the nuance of being in a lifelong partnership with all its ups and downs and sometimes silences and drony sections and troubles and love. And ultimately, I think it's a play about love, not silly love, really deep, intimate, revealing love and daring. It's very daring in the scope of how it deals with these two older people and how they reconcile, forgive each other, still spar with each other, are very funny with each other, and in extremis. And again, what I was listening to John there, I love the thing he's saying about a ticking clock. It's just, you just got to get on and get this sorted out, you know. And the character of Liam says at one point, because it's all done, and she says, it's not done. Not yet. So we do. It's a great play. I hope lots of people come and see it.
I'm aware that we've skipped around it a little bit. Maybe just tell us where we find Adele and Liam at the very beginning of the play, because the two of them, they're kind of dealing with the impending end of the world in different ways.
Yeah, it's an actor's dream because John has given us both two very strong actions. Liam is engrossed on type and to finish writing his memoirs. He's a sort of a failed writer or a teacher who would have liked to have been a writer. And Adele has obviously done some kind of a art degree, but she works in a gallery. So you've got two people who are maybe just, they've had a family together, but he is very focused on this external legacy, leaving a message to the world, memoirs that he's writing. And she is very focused on contacting her children. So they're both engrossed in sort of crazy piles of tech. She's got a laptop and phones and tries everything, you know, even an old CB radio to contact her children who don't live in the country anymore. Her daughter has married an Australian and her son is in London. And then you've got the other character, Liam, her husband, is sitting at another desk with his back to her on an old style bash it out typewriter, which I think is also very interesting because you think of 2048 and like John was saying there, pre-pandemic, pre all the chaos of the last 10 years, you were thinking you'd be having, you know, I don't know, teleportation and some kind of crazy progress in technology. But actually there's a sense of that humans have destroyed everything. And so we've almost regressed as we go into the future. You know, we've destroyed the lot. So
two-hander plays like this can be very intense experiences. What's it been like so far in terms of rehearsals?
It's very intense, is what it is. There's four of us in the room. There's the stage manager, fabulous Louise, and there's Jimmy Fay, who's the fabulous director, and there's myself and Patrick O'Kane, the fabulous, spectacular actor that he is. And I've known Patrick since I was in my 20s, and we're exactly the same age, bar about 6 months. So we have a lifetime I wouldn't say friendship, but connection. You know, we know the same people, and we've both been in the profession a long time. So it's fun. We're having a real laugh. The stage manager today said she was glad to be getting home out of this madhouse, is what she said. So yeah, it is intense though, you know, because you have to actually do a lot of work. I mean, I would always do a lot of work at home, but because there's no in-between scenes where you sit down and can do a little bit of a sneaky look at the script, you've got to come with your work game ready, you know.
John,
there's only us in it.
Yeah, there are only the two of you and then the voices that we hear. John, was it important to you? Because obviously what's happening in the world outside is slightly nondescript. We're not really overly sure what is happening. There are explosions. There are things that happen outside. Was that important to you to keep that vague enough that it didn't take focus away from the action of what's happening on stage?
Yeah, because I think if I was going to kind of denote exactly what it was, then I felt like the audience might spend too much time maybe thinking about that and trying to actually maybe create some kind of roadmap in their head for how it got to that point. Whereas what was more interesting for me was the vagueness, where it can pretty much just be whatever keeps you up at night, you know, whatever you feel dread about in the greater world and what's going on in the world. That can be the thing if you want it to be, I guess.
It's entitled Denouement. Why that choice of title?
I really grappled with it for a long time because it is hard to pronounce and it's also a bit pretentious, but it felt like it was...
You went with it in the end?
I went with it in the end. No, there was a lot of options thrown around, but it was one of those things where, like, the first title that lands in your head feels like it's the right title. And particularly with the nature of Liam's character is this kind of thwarted writer who's never completed a finished work. And the idea of, you know, the word denouement meaning, you know, it's the resolution of a story or it's the tying up of loose knots. And it just felt like it was an accurate title for what's actually happening. And of course, the play is happening at the end. It's the end of the world and it's the end of everyone's story, effectively. So as much as I grappled with it, it just ultimately felt like it was the right choice.
And I'm conscious that this might make the play sound as if it's incredibly dark and incredibly depressing and the world is about to end and that is all upon us. But there is light in the play. There's a great deal of humour.
There's a great deal of humour. And sure, darkness and light are cheek by jowl, aren't they, really? And some of the best comedy comes out of the grimmest of situations. I think some of the comedy is kind of the absurd position that these two people find themselves in, and that the whole world finds us in, because there is the epic of what's going on outside and the little opera of this ordinary couple trying to sort out their relationship at the end of time. And it sort of expands into a giant symphony of sound externally as we get quieter and quieter as we reveal ourselves and what have you. And there are some, well, spoiler alert, we have an encounter from a little paramour, and that is awful and hilarious at the same time.
And sound is very important in this play because there's so much that comes from it.
Yes, it's a very hard play to just read because the soundscape is really the third character of the play. And the audience, particularly in the Lyric, they've installed a new system that is a sound surround. So they're going to feel they're involved in the cataclysmic event that's unfolding. Because it'll be in the auditorium with them, coming from everywhere, you know. So I think it's going to be a wonderful experience. And both of us, we don't really sit down very much. It's not just two people sitting at desks. I'm up and down ladders, up and down to a cellar. We have a bit of funky chicken dancing to James Brown, good music. It's really unfolding to be a bit of a wow.
So. John, as the writer, and particularly when it comes to Denouement, tell me about your influences, both maybe inside and outside the theatre for this piece.
There's a fairly wide range of stuff in there. I mean, there's a little bit of Beckett, I suppose, that I was definitely influenced by. And also, like, kind of slightly post-apocalyptic or futuristic kind of dystopian stuff like Children of Men or Cormac McCarthy's The Road. There's a little tinge of that in it with the survivalist nature. And then that Raymond Briggs book, When the Wind Blows, which is about an elderly couple in rural England during nuclear fallout. And there was a great animated film that was made by Jimmy Murakami. And that was kind of an influence as well. It was kind of hard to avoid that one once I kind of landed on the idea, because I suppose it's the kind of closest thing I've found that is like it. So there was a mix of that. I guess, like, looking at kind of slightly futuristic or dystopian stories, there was a lot of them that I was kind of putting into the stew, because I also felt like it's not something that you necessarily see in Irish theatre, and rightfully so. I mean, I think most playwrights naturally would maybe recoil from doing something that's future tinged, because it can date a play very easily and very quickly. And that's what maybe why it's a little bit easier to look back into plays like as in the past. And I've done a lot of that myself, but with this, it kind of felt fun to maybe take a look at an imagined future. And of course, it might completely date the play in a couple of years' time. And hopefully, you know, it's not going to be as bad in 2048 as the play thinks it's going to be. So it was fun to kind of play around with an imagined idea of where we might be and what the country might be like.
Denouement was part of the Lyrics New Writing Programme. How important was that opportunity for yourself and for other writers as well?
Very important. I mean, I submitted for the New Writers Programme, but I didn't get on the New Writers Programme. But the consolation prize that I got was they commissioned the play. Because you have to
That's
submit...
some consolation prize.
It was a great consolation prize, in fairness. I didn't complain. So it was like... It was a sample script that I'd sent as part of my application, and then I didn't get it, but I got the commission, so it all worked out pretty well. But I mean, the Lyric have a fantastic reputation for developing so many new writers and new voices, and there's such a pedigree of new writing there that I was really chuffed to be part of that, and to have to play on there now, you know, finally getting to the stage, it's a big deal for me. So particularly considering like how well they have presented new writing and a variety of new writing like over the last couple of decades. Yeah, it's very cool.
It's been great to talk to both of you tonight. Writer John Morton, actor Anna Healy, thanks for joining us on Arena. Denouement will be performed at the Lyric Theatre as part of the Belfast International Arts Festival from the 21st of October to the 15th of November, and it'll be directed by Jimmy Fay. For more details about the play and the festival, you can go to belfastinternationalartsfestival.com.
Don't let foot pain or discomfort hold you back. At Foot Solutions, we specialise in high-quality supportive footwear and use the latest scanning technology to custom-make orthotics designed for your unique feet. Book your free foot assessment at footsolutions.ie or pop in store today.
With colder days and longer nights, energy bills can feel unpredictable. But with Uno Energy, you're never in the dark. See what you've spent each day and even get a forecast of your next bill so you're always one step ahead. Join Uno Energy today and save up to €945 a year on dual fuel. With Uno Energy, you just know. Uno Energy discount variable electricity rate, EAB €1,323. Discount variable gas rate, €1,151. For T's and C's rates and savings calculations, see unoenergy.ie. Suppliers pricing may change. Uno Energy.
100 years after his birth in West Point, New York, Gore Vidal remains a towering figure of 20th century American literature. A prolific writer with over 30 novels, countless essays and plays, beginning with his debut novel Willowaw to the groundbreaking The City and the Pillar, Vidal explored themes like sexuality and power. As a public intellectual, he was a staple of television shows where his urbane charm and biting critiques captivated audiences. His irreverence, from skewering the then President Ronald Reagan to feuding with literary giants, made him an unforgettable character, and his incisive voice still resonates in today's discourse. Let's have a little listen to him.
The good news is the election is over. The bad news, prepare yourself. Ronald Reagan's library just burned down. Both books were destroyed. But the real horror, he had not finished coloring the second.
Paul Whittington joins me now to discuss the life and works of Gore Vidal. Paul, let's start at the beginning. Who was he?
He was the son of two sort of upper class socialites, if you like. His father, Jean Vidal, was a very successful aviator, a lover of Amelia Earhart. He founded several airlines. He was in the FDR administration. He was an advisor. And his mother, Nina, was this very sort of powerful kind of socialite and sometime actress whom Gore couldn't stand his mother, and she didn't much like him. But he grew up in privilege. But crucially for him, his grandfather, Thomas Gore, was a kind of lion of the Democrat Party. I think he helped found the state of Oklahoma, and he was blind. And so as a child, Gore read to him, which you know, it led to his love of books, and he also was a page on the Senate floor. He was a big fan of the Roman Empire. He read all the Roman historians, and he became entranced with this idea, this comparison between Rome and Washington, which constantly made to Washington's detriment, usually.
And we should point out for anybody who wonders, he was a very, very very vague, distant relative to Al Gore, somewhere sixth cousin, twice removed.
There's some, like there's some kind of confusion about that because he said he was, and in 2000 when Gore was running for the election, which of course he lost in controversial circumstances. How history might have been different had he won, but he may have been, and he traced their lineage to these 16th century Anglo-Irish types in Donegal. But there was a connection, and also a connection to Ireland, which he was quite pleased about himself.
Yeah, maybe before we do anything else, talk to us about that, because he did mention it on many occasions.
He did mention it, and he wasn't sure. There was a Gore who came here who was a very successful businessman and sort of politician and owned half the county at one point, whether the locals liked it or not, and he had two sons who were very successful also, and Gore wasn't sure which one they were related to, but they were related to one or the other. And he had his partner in later life, his life partner Howard Austin, said that Gore had this fantasy of himself as a sort of Irish country gentleman a la Barry Lyndon and dreamed of coming over here to stay, but Howard wouldn't. He wanted to stay in Italy. He was having none of that.
That makes sense. He was disarmingly honest at times. I want to talk about his memoir, Palimpsest.
Yes.
And you highly mentioned already. Yeah, it is. It's a great read. And you've already mentioned already his mother doesn't come out well in that at all.
No, he said that she had no maternal instinct and she didn't see me and I wished I didn't see her. They just didn't get on. I think she had an alcohol problem, which, you know, some people say in later life he did himself. Perhaps they were too similar in some ways, but he got on much better with his father. And his grandfather, as I said, was the crucial influence in his life. He learned to read in his library, even though he sounded like he did. He had this incredibly plummy voice that makes sort of Fraser Crane sound working class. But he was an autodidact. He didn't go to university after school. He was in the US, the sort of naval part of the US Army during the end of the war, didn't really see much active service. And thereafter, he was too busy writing. He was a success by the time he was 20, as was his mortal and sworn enemy, Truman Capote. And those two never liked each other. But he started writing and he kept writing, you know, 30 novels, screenplays, plays, those essays, of course.
He was a man for the bon mot as well. He's once quoted as saying, never turn down the opportunity to have sex or appear on television.
Yes, yes.
And regarding the television appearances anyway, he seems to have never done that because he was on US TV in a certain period a lot.
An awful lot. And he was very interesting in that because a lot of writers who took themselves seriously would have thought it beneath them to appear on sort of game shows and late night talk shows and Playboy TV and all this stuff. But he did. He liked it and he realised that it was important, especially as he realised that he was a public intellectual, but also because he had political ambitions. He stood twice. He never won. But friends, including his nephew, said that he really did dream of one day becoming president, which was partly why he despised Bobby Kennedy so much.
Because this was a time, and it might seem astonishing to anybody now, because it's not a thing that happens in 2025, when somebody who considered themselves a public intellectual was prime fodder for chat shows in the States.
Absolutely. And you can look at all this online. Dick Cavett, Merv Griffin, all these people, like, they were incredibly, in America, they were not, ill-disposed towards intellectuals. Most Americans were and are, of course. But these people turned up on television, him and Norman Mailer having these debates on and almost fistfights on Dick Cavett. Obviously, the very famous debates he had with William Buckley on during the ABC coverage of the 1968 presidential election. He was on everything, but the level at which he kind of spoke and debated was extraordinary. But he saw no problem with that, although I think sometimes he was taken less seriously because he was so much on television.
I want to go back to his writing career. So he was 19 when he published Willibald, his debut novel. It's about soldiers on a US Army boat. And at least loosely based on his own wartime service?
Oh, very much based on his own wartime stories. And there are kind of, there are gay subtexts in it, which, you know, obviously became more apparent in The City and the Pillar. There was no subtext in that, it was all in the text. But it was really well received and sort of straight away he was a famous writer. And he he knew how to make that work for him, and he was interested in money. Like he bought this very grand house in his, I think he was hardly 30, in upstate New York, and then he realized he had to finance it, and he later went to Hollywood to pay for his lifestyle. But success came to him quick, and he obviously he got into big trouble with City and the Pillar because it was an overtly gay love story between two men, and he was castigated for that. And actually, for several years, he wrote Potboilers under a nom de plume to earn himself more money. Yeah.
Because this is a part of his story that I didn't know.
Yeah.
In the 50s, so crime novels under a pseudonym?
Yes, crime novels under a pseudonym. Like the pseudonym itself eludes me at the moment. It's here somewhere. But he did. And I only discovered that when after Palimpsest, not in Palimpsest. He doesn't talk about them. And he didn't like them being attributed to him. Like, it wasn't some sort of game. He just always wrote, and he always made money writing, which I wish I knew his secret, but he managed to do it.
He goes to Hollywood. What happens to him then when he's there?
He became highly in demand as a script doctor and William White at MGM, where he was employed for a number of years. And he most famously worked on Ben-Hur, and he with a screenplay which was a total unmanageable mess, and he rewrote it. Large portions of it, and he also, as he spoke afterwards in the in a documentary about it, he spoke of how he had inserted a kind of a covert gay element into the relationship between Charlton Heston's character and his Roman friend, and Charlton. And when you watch the film, it makes sense because why was this animus between them? Charlton Heston happily never worked this out because I don't think he would have been very happy about it afterwards.
I think I saw the same documentary. He famously claimed that he wrote the snails and oysters line that Laurence Olivier uses.
Yeah, we think he did write that. Yeah, but he was very good at it. But Hollywood was a kind of sideshow for him, and in fact, he left Hollywood partly because Kennedy came to power and he wanted to run in the as a candidate in the 1960 election, which he did.
Okay, I want to take a clip of him going toe-to-toe with Norman Mailer. This is Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer. Just bear with it. Exchanging insults for almost 30 minutes, we're not playing all of it, on the Dick Cavett Show in 1971.
I make my case very carefully. But I will say, giving you a few minutes more on the program, you will prove my point. It is, I come back to what I said, I detest this violence in you. You have actually written that murder is never non-sexual.
Well, is it ever non-sexual?
Well, I'm even
don't
told...
Don't you know, Gore?
Not having murdered anybody lately, no, I don't know. I'm going to give you a line that Degas said to Whistler, two celebrated painters. And Whistler was a great performer like Norman. And Degas said, you know, Whistler, you act as if you had no talent.
Why do you think they rubbed each other up the wrong way, or why Mailer rubbed Gore Vidal up the wrong way?
I think that Gore was rather amused by Mailer, and he accepted that Mailer had talent, which he did. But he found this kind of sub-Hemingway macho man thing that he did very tiresome, this public persona. Now, Gore had a public persona as well. He was actually very shy and quiet, apparently, and rather introverted in real life, as writers often are. But he invented this kind of, you know, patrician grandee thing but he could hide behind. But he found Norman's annoying, and that Dick Cavett show, he tried to headbutt him after that. And then at a cocktail party a couple of years afterwards, he punched him. And Gore Vidal famously said, Norman, words have failed you. So you couldn't win against him. He must have been infuriated.
Tell me about the political ambitions, because it wasn't just once, and he was somebody who genuinely believed that he could have potentially made it big.
He had deep feeling for politics. I mean, there's one thing you would recommend people read apart from Palimpsest. I mean, his historical novels are very good. He called himself America's biographer. He wasn't hiding behind the bush. But his essays, there's a collection called United States, I think 1952 to 1992. That is phenomenal, buy it, and it's full of these wonderful essays about books, but also about politics. He was fascinated by politics. He wanted to make a difference. He believed he grew tired of the Democrats eventually, and believed he ran for a sort of third party candidate in 1982. But in 1960, He got on very well with JFK to begin with. And obviously, Jackie was a relative of his, a cousin of his through marriage. So, and he was well got in Camelot. He was there, he was behind the scenes, and he ran. Unfortunately, as you can hear when he talks, he lacked the common touch. He was tall, he was a great public speaker, but he didn't sound like people, and he ordinary people, he found it hard to, you know, the blue collar thing was not for Gore, and I think that was the problem. That's why he just couldn't break through in America, and it did hurt him.
He ends up playing a character that's almost a version of the politician he could have become in Bob Roberts, in Tim Robbins' directorial debut.
Yeah, he does. He didn't do much acting, but he quite liked it. I don't think he really had to act in that. He just did him. He just did the public him. But yeah, he politics continued to fascinate him, and he was perhaps the great... one wonders... you don't have to wonder how he would have been now. He was great at poking fun at America's tendency towards performative patriotism and... the sort of obsession with Christianity to the detriment of democracy. He was very interested in all that, and I don't think he would have been shocked by what has happened since he died. He died in 2012.
He decamped to Italy eventually. Why did that happen?
Well, he was in Rome, actually. I think he was in Rome before Ben-Hur, and he knew Rome from before, and he loved Rome. So initially he bought an apartment there. And then I think after he became a bit disgusted after, you know, when everything went sour after the JFK assassination, and then, Martin Luther King and all that sort of stuff. And he decided to stay in Italy most of the time, and him and his partner Howard Austin found this amazing place overlooking the sea and above Amalfi, and he said it was, you know, the perfect place from which to observe the decline of Western civilization and so forth. And he wrote all the great... He had this lovely writing room. You could hear the sea far below, and he wrote all his big all his major historical novels about America there.
If you've ever seen the documentaries about him, you'll know that that was also the location for some quite legendary parties as well. It seemed that everybody turned up at one point.
Yeah, Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, Andy Warhol, about whom he wasn't very nice, actually. And he was Sting, everybody, people came there. Tim Robbins, when he was a thing. And he liked to have parties, but it was Howard was more the host than him. He was the quieter one. But yeah, absolutely. That became a real magnet for all sorts of people. And he became a very European American in the manner of Henry James, in a way, whom he really admired. But he kept going back. He kept going back to America. And as I mentioned, he took part in some amazing debates, particularly the Buckley debates, which are fascinating.
Well, I'm glad we've made it to that point. Let's talk about his relationship with William F. Buckley.
If we can call it that.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe first explain to us who Buckley was, and then why they had such a fractious relationship. We do have a clip to play here.
Well, he was kind of like a dark mirror image of Gore Vidal and the way William Buckley. He's a very significant figure. I mean, he is credited, for better or worse, with starting this kind of whole alt-right thing that led to... the National Enquirer, his magazine, that led to Barry Goldwater, and then to Reagan, and then to what we have now. He was a very serious intellectual. He had this TV program for years on which he invited on people he didn't agree with. Imagine doing that in America now, and would have these great, you know, James Baldwin, all these very serious people who were on the opposite side of the fence to him, and he would talk to them in a kind of courteous manner. His courtesy failed him totally when he got involved with Gore Vidal. The two had been circling each other for a while, and then ABC, which were... there's a very funny documentary about all this called Best of Enemies, and in it somebody says that ABC was the third network in America. If there'd been a fourth, it would have been fourth. Like, they had no money, their sets collapsed during the 1968 presidential debates, but they had somebody had the brilliant idea of getting these two guys. Buckley sounded every bit as patrician and snotty as Gore did, and used $10 words all the time. And people were fascinated by them. They, imagine it, but they had brilliant ratings. These two, you know, arid intellectuals, but they really did not get on.
I'm going to take a little clip from that, and it might help explain its success at the time. This is the moment when William F. Buckley loses it during their TV debates on ABC, and it's during the 1968 presidential election season.
Mr. Vidal, wasn't it a provocative act to try to raise the Viet Cong flag in the park in the film we just saw?
Wouldn't that invite raising a Nazi flag in World War II would have had similar consequences?
You're so naive.
People in the United States happen to believe that the United States policy is wrong in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong are correct in wanting to organize their country in their own way politically. If it is a novelty in Chicago, that is too bad. But I assume that the point of the American democracy
and some
is you can express
Nazi,
any
some
point of view you want.
Nazi.
Shut up a minute.
No, I won't. And some people were pro-Nazi, and the answer is that they were well-treated by people who ostracized them, and I'm for ostracizing people who egg on other people to shoot American Marines and American soldiers. I know you don't care.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro-crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
And you can find an awful lot more of that on YouTube, I'm sure, if you want to check it out.
Yes, it's all on YouTube, and that documentary, Best of Enemies, is fascinating. Yeah, and so that was the moment that now William Buckley, nobody bested him. He was a brilliant debater, but Gore did. He got to him, and there was very real. Gore said afterwards that you could see Buckley's spindly arms moving around. He looked like he was going to hit him, and you could see Vidal's eyelids fluttering because he thought he was going to get hit. It was an amazing moment. The whole thing was amazing, though, the level at which they had been debating and the ways, various ways in which they really weren't concentrating on the politics. They were trying to attack each other. And Buckley knew he lost then and he regretted it. There was a lawsuit afterwards. But Gore had a picture of the debates in his toilet, in his home in Amalfi. And when he was, as he said himself, a great hater, when Buckley died, you know, a few years before him, he said, RIP, WFB in hell. So they never forgave each other.
You have to wonder what he would have made of today's America, of Donald Trump.
Well, I think you can gauge that. I mean, obviously, Ronald Reagan looks like George Washington next to what's going on now. But he was very funny. He called Reagan a triumph of the embalmer's art. And I think that he would not have been surprised because he did predict this. He thought that the people were making end runs around the Constitution. He thought that America, democracy had been sort of polluted by the military-industrial complex in the 1950s, as Noam Chomsky believed as well. And so he would not have been surprised by this. He might have been surprised by the person at the head of it, but not by the thing itself.
His name might be familiar, but do people still read his books these days? Because I'll be honest with you, the only time I ever really see them outside of the couple I have on my own bookshelves are in secondhand bookstores where there's usually at least two or three Gore Vidal novels.
Well, when he was still alive, he worried about that, and he decided that he was going to be forgotten. In some measure he has, because there used to be a vast, you'll remember, a vast array of books of his. I think that in America, the historical novels and the, you know, Burr, Lincoln, 1874. These are really good, by the way. They're wonderful read.
I think Burr got a little bump after Hamilton became such a success because it is.
Yes, because it's kind of all about that. It doesn't quite elide with that idea of Hamilton, but they're marvelous books. So they are still read. The thing he is and probably will be famous for in sort of literary circles is the essays, because he was a real admirer of Montesquieu and all these people, and he believed in the form and he was brilliant at it, and he wrote them constantly over. And as I said, that collection, United States, is an extraordinary book.
And if we've whetted people's appetite to see a little bit more about him, the Best of Enemies documentary.
Yes, and you mentioned the
United States of Amnesia.
Yeah, which is really good as well. Yeah, yeah. Just listen to him on YouTube. He's a fascinating character.
Paul Whittington, thank you for joining me as always, and for marking the centenary of the birth of the American writer and essayist Gore Vidal. He is, in his own mind anyway, one of Britain's once favourite broadcasters. Hard done by the BBC, but over his long career, from sports reporter to chat show host to North Norfolk digital radio presenter, he has shown remarkable staying power. Alan Partridge is the most beloved creation of Steve Coogan, and this week Alan returns with his first show in 4 years called How Are You? I'm Alan Partridge. It sees the veteran broadcaster conduct what he sees as the UK's first ever documentary on mental health. And here's a little clip of what to expect.
Promoting mental health might not be cool or trendy, but I happen to believe in using my platform to help others. I was told you threw a brick at a swan?
The goose.
Goose. Which is why, in Britain's first ever documentary about mental health...
You're panicking, Lynn. Breathe.
I'm stopping, crouching down and asking...
How are you?
It's Alan Partridge.
Where did Norfolk's finest broadcaster come from, and how and why has he weathered the fashions and fads of comedy for well over 30 years? Joining me now is another equally important Alan, Alan Corr of RTE Entertainment, to capture the essence of Alan and to parse the Partridge. Alan, we've known and loved Alan Partridge for, it's almost 30 years now. Where did he come from?
Well, Alan Gordon Partridge is the frankly genius creation of Manchester Irish comedian and actor Steve Coogan and comedy writer Armando Iannucci. He made his debut in 1991 on Radio 4 series On the Hour, later on television on The Day Today. Both of those shows were wicked parodies of the news media. And Alan would have started out as this rather inane sports presenter. And for people who don't know, he's kind of a little Englander from Norfolk, and he deals with the Daily Mail, tells him what to do. He's a very, very inflated ego and a great warm welcome for himself. He ended up getting his own show, Knowing Me, Knowing You, on BBC TV in the mid-90s, which ended very badly. That was a mock chat show and ended very badly. When he shot dead one of his guests live on air with an antique pistol. And since then, since 1991, Coogan keeps bringing Alan back. There's been a biography, there's been a very good film called Alpha Papa, there's been podcasts, and there's even been a stage show which Coogan brought to Dublin in 2022. So to use an Alan expression, he keeps bouncing back.
I think I would have seen him for the very first time on The Day Today, the Chris Morris show, but Knowing Me, Knowing You was probably the one that brought him into kind of centre stage of public perception. Remind us why it was such a good comedy programme.
Well, I think this was at a time when the chat show was still, I suppose, a viable TV thing. Now, it's debatable whether that's the case or not. So this would have been about 1994. And what it did so brilliantly was dissect, you know, what makes the chat show work. And it's all down to the host. Now, Alan Partridge, the host, was extremely egotistical. He had very little time for his guests. It was all about him. So there's nothing more the media likes talking about than the media. So he would have got a lot of attention from, you know, the likes of the Guardian newspaper. It was very clever, accessible comedy that sent up a very hackneyed TV format, which, of course, is the chat show. So he became this kind of, he started off as one-dimensional, but I think Knowing Me, Knowing You brought him to a bigger audience, and it also kind of satirized what people were watching, chat shows and those kind of magazine format programs, and it really kind of did boost his profile hugely.
Talk to me about the personality of Alan's character, because I think it's one of the things that has made him survive for so long is that absolutely he is a little Englander, and he is very much self-centred and drives a Range Rover and has driving gloves. But ultimately, he's not a dislikable character in the long run, is he?
Well, I think that's the genius of Coogan's creation, despite all his foibles and kind of egotism. I mean, he is, you know, quite likable. People have an affection for him. He's got this kind of boyishness about him. He's intimidated by women, for example. He has kind of displayed fairly prejudicial views over the years. But he is likeable in a strange way. As I say, he would have started off as one-dimensional, as chauvinist as it were, but he's turned into this great tragicomic character, one of the great tragicomic characters of the past 30 years, I think, you know, not unlike David Brent in The Office. So he has evolved from, you know, that one-dimensional character in something bigger, and he's become really part of the cultural fabric in a lot of ways, Rick. I mean, there's a popular Instagram and Twitter account called Accidental Partridge, in which TV hosts like Eamon Holmes and Noel Edmonds are caught out saying things, the kind of things that Alan would say without any kind of self-awareness. So Alan has got a lack of self-awareness. And I think that we sympathise and empathise with him more than we care to admit.
I think there are versions of Accidental Partridge on pretty much every social media platform these days, and they are usually worth a look. Talk to me about the influence that certainly up until now anyway, that either the series or that Alan himself has kind of had on other comedies, those that have followed on.
Well, I think that, you know, you could call this the comedy of the cringe, comedy of cringe. Around about the same time that Alan was getting very, very popular, Larry David would have come along with Curb Your Enthusiasm, slightly later than that. The Office would have arrived about 2002 and thereabouts, and later on in the decade, you had the likes of Peep Show and The Inbetweeners. All of those programmes would have made humour out of that comedy of cringe. And in many ways, Alan Partridge reminds me of Basil Bolte, in that he is willing to go to these extremes of kind of egotism, and he thinks everyone else is wrong. And I think Alan, Larry, and Basil, and David Brent, and all of those kind of grotesques, likable grotesques, albeit, I'm not sure about Basil in that respect, but they all kind of seem to actually accentuate that idea that embarrassing situations were the new form of comedy, the kind of stuff that would make you cringe. And I think that Coogan and people like Anoushi, Patrick Marber, his fellow writers, they've all fairly revolutionized the idea of what passes for funny over the past 20, 25 years. So hugely influential, I think.
You met Steve Coogan himself a number of times over the years. So what is he like himself as a person?
Yeah, I would have met him quite a few times going back to as far as 1994. I mean, he's one of six children from an Irish Manchester family, born in 1965. He would have started his career in Spitting Image. He's that, you know, cliche of the truly gifted comedian, Rick. He's fiercely intelligent, but he's also very serious. I mean, Alan Partridge's every utterance and accent is studied and weighed to see if it's something Alan would actually say. And I've always thought that Coogan is in many ways the natural heir to Peter Sellers, a man who also went to extremes for his own art. I think Coogan now is 58. He's boyish and urbane. In his 20s now, he was a totally different person, a bit of a playboy, actually. But he's kind of matured into a very serious comic. He's intensely private. He's been married once. He has one grown-up daughter. And we do not know a lot about Steve Coogan's private life. And that's just the way he wants it, I think.
His politics is probably as far to the other side of the spectrum as it could be from Alan's.
Very much so. Coogan would be left-wing. He would have been a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. And only 2 days ago, he called on British Prime Minister Keir Starmer to, describe the Israel's actions in Gaza as genocide. So he is very decidedly left-wing and very interested in politics and also interested in press intrusion. He would have been very vocal during the phone hacking scandal back in the noughties, and he has been campaigning against press intrusion for the past 15 years or so. So very different from Alan indeed, Rick.
There's a lot of other people, and you mentioned it briefly, who've found themselves attracted to Alan's orbit over the years. Actors, people like Patrick Marber, who's the theatre director and writer, Rebecca Front, Tim Key was in the most recent North Norfolk digital-based series. That's something that tends to have, people do tend to want to work with Alan as a character.
Oh, absolutely, very, very much so. I always remember there's a very kind of funny live performance of Alan and Noel Gallagher, no less, of Oasis, who is one of the funniest men I've ever met, rocks up, and even he can't outquip Alan. And I think this thing is so highly scripted and so crafted. People know they're kind of dealing with a professional here. They know they're dealing with someone who's really worked through this. So the people he has worked with over the years since the early 90s, very high quality people who have gone on, like Rebecca Front, who have gone on to bigger and greater careers as well. Another show that I think Alan would have had an influence on is the likes of In the Thick of It, In the Loop, the movie, which is Armando Nucci's film about spin doctors. So, yeah, I think he attracts very high quality people because they're guaranteed to be involved with a very high quality production.
For people who maybe have never seen Alan Partridge before, they may have seen the clip that I'm about to play now. It's the Black and Tans song from his, I think, second last but one series on the BBC, or the most recent one for the BBC. Maybe could you set this one up for us as to how it happens and the nature of the series it came in?
Well, Coogan is proudly half Irish. And Alan has mentioned Ireland and the Irish over the years on the day-to-day and Knowing Me, Knowing You. But I think the most brilliant thing he did for Irish audiences was back in 2019 when Sligo Farmer and Alan Lookalike Martin Brennan appeared on this time with Alan Partridge on BBC. And he was played by Coogan himself, but Partridge is horrified when Martin Brennan starts singing Come Out Ye Black and Tans and The Men Behind the Wire on live TV.
Let's give it a moment, shall we?
Come out, you black and tan, come and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like Calloway. Run the green and lovely lanes of Kilashandra. Armoured cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons. But every man should stand behind the men behind the wire.
Come on, Simon!
That was grand, that. Mighty. Yeah. Double O fecking bollocks.
Oh, my God, that was like an advert for the IRA. Who are we going to blame? Find out who booked them in Saka.
I have a clip as well, Alan, of you meeting Steve Coogan in London back in 2020 when you asked him about it.
Steve, were you taken aback by the reaction to Come Out Ye Black and Tans when you did it on the show last March?
I was hoping that my fellow... Irishman, as someone who's half Irish, would appreciate it, and they did, you know. It was kind of like a little in joke. It was almost like a sort of private bet. Like, I wonder if we could get just for the mischief of it, can we get an Irish rebel song on primetime BBC One? And we managed to do that.
It was pretty remarkable. It was pretty. I mean,
we've
pretty
got two Irish rebel songs. Actually.
Well, that's true. You also had the Men Behind the Wire.
Yeah.
So you challenged yourself. Was there much pushback against the idea?
No. I mean, because it was sort of it's an in joke for us, but the fact is it works comically because Alan Partridge plays a member of the establishment who's appalled by it, and that's where the comedy comes from. So artistically, it's entirely justifiable, but it's also something that makes me have a private chuckle.
What do we know about Alan's new series starting on the BBC this Friday?
Well, yeah, this is called How Are You? I'm Alan, in brackets, Partridge. And we follow Alan as he returns to the UK after doing promotional work in Saudi Arabia. And he's attempting to rebuild his career once again through a documentary series about mental health. And in the clip we heard earlier on, he describes this as the first ever documentary about mental health. So that's the beauty of Partridge. He's reactivated by Coogan when Alan has something to say about the modern world. Coogan himself has described the new show as a Trojan horse in which he can kind of talk about issues that people are anxious to bring up. And we've also learned a couple of things about his private life as well. He has a new girlfriend. Her name is Katrina, whom he describes as one of the fittest women over 40 in Norfolk, and whom the Gibbons brothers, who are his co-writers, say was originally based on Liz Truss. So the mind boggles there. Alan also engages with cancel culture. And as you know, Rick, there's been a lot of cancelling of BBC and ITV presenters over the past couple of years. So Alan would have a lot to say about that, I think.
In 2002, just to finish Alan briefly, he described Alan Partridge as an albatross that keeps coming back to him, but not necessarily in a bad way.
Well, an Alan-tross, if you will, Rick. not necessarily a bad way at all, because, I mean, Coogan, as far back in 2002, as you said, that, like, you know, he's trying to rest him and move on to other characters. But I think he's since accepted that Alan will always define who Steve Coogan is, and he doesn't want to kill the golden goose. So, as I say, and I've asked him about this before during interviews, that, you know, Coogan could go back to Alan when he needs to, every 3, 4, 5 years or so. And hopefully there'll be another movie, because Alpha Papa back in 2013 was very good. And Alan can become that voice to kind of, you know, satirise prejudice and privilege. So he's got that luxurious position of being able to do these movies and other projects, but also bring Alan back when he wants. And I think that he's long reconciled himself to the fact that Steve Coogan will always be Alan Partridge.
Alan Corr from RTE Entertainment, thanks for joining us tonight. We will be reviewing How Are You? I'm Alan Partridge on Friday Night's Arena. That's it for us tonight. Produced by Reg Luby, Paula Shields was our researcher. Our broadcast coordinator, Ollie Hamilton, and Paul Murnock was on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea. I will talk to you tomorrow night from 7 and up after news, John Creedon.